The death of Robin Williams this week surprised many of his fans, who wondered how someone so adept at making them laugh could have sunk into such a deep depression. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about the ways to recognize when people we know are struggling and how we should approach them to offer help. Also, we kick off a new series on community today called We Are the Valley. Patricia Gober will tell us about traditional views of community, where Phoenix fits in, and how this area is expanding upon the definition. Plus, the chair of the Arizona Republican Party claims Democrats are disenfranchising some of the state's voters by having so many unopposed primary races. I'll ask Democratic consultant Bob Grossfeld about how the party's presumptive nominees are preparing for November's general election. And longtime Valley artist and writer Bob Bowes-Bell has become an authority on Old West history, but today we'll hear his own story of growing up along Route 66. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll kick off a new series on community, what it means and where it can be found. It's called We Are the Valley. Today, I'll talk with Patricia Gober of ASU, author of the book Metropolitan Phoenix, Placemaking and Community Building in the Desert. Also, there isn't a lot of competition in Democratic primary races, which Arizona Republican Party Chair Robert Graham says is disenfranchising more than 2 million voters. I'll ask Democratic strategist Bob Grossfeld what he thinks of that characterization. Plus, longtime Valley artist and writer Bob Bowes-Bell is finally telling his own childhood story of growing up along Route 66. I'll talk with him about the legendary road and why it's been so meaningful. We start today's program with a conversation about mental illness and depression in the wake of the suspected suicide of actor and comedian Robin Williams. How can we help friends who are going through bouts of depression? When do we talk to them? When should we leave them alone? To discuss those questions and others, I'm joined by Jim Dunn, Executive Director of Arizona's chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Jim, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And by phone from Fort Bragg, California, S.E. Smith, Social Justice Editor at exojane.com. S.E., good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. Now, S.E., let me start with you. You wrote this week that you know people want those they care about to get help, talk to someone if they're in an especially tough place. Is there a best thing a friend can do? Does the situation have to dictate that?
One of the things I covered in my piece for ExoJane is that in the reaction to celebrity suicides, people tend to think about mental health crises more than the need for ongoing support of the mentally ill community. And the real takeaway I want people to have from this news is that it's time to start breaking down mental health stigma and to create a world where people never reach the point where they're in crisis in the first place.
Jim, how do we get to that level?
I don't know, but I really thank SE for that well-written article. I think it was very well done, and I was kind of disappointed to see some of the conversations on the thread that followed. It just seems to get so vitriolic so quickly. But, you know, it takes a relationship, and that's, I think, what SE had pointed out. You know, it's just as simple as a relationship. Every family has conflict, but you don't quit each other.
SE, I guess when we talk about getting to a point where I don't want to say people are more accepting of it, but realizing that these are not just major events that the news is going to cover for a few days, are there certain steps you'd advise us all to take? Should we try to recognize what's going on? I sort of feel like, when do we back off and when do people who are going through a mental health episode feel like they're being smothered by the help?
One of the biggest takeaways I think that people should definitely think about is kind of in their daily interactions, being aware that mentally ill people are probably all around them, even if they're not aware of that. And it's important to be sensitive about how they talk about mental illness and how they address people, not necessarily to assume that someone is not mentally ill. And when you see someone in crisis, not to say, oh, you should go get help, but rather to say, I'm here for you, I'm listening, I want you to know that I support you. Can I help you make an appointment with a therapist? And to be supportive and say, I want you to know you are valued. I want you to know you're making concrete contributions to my life or to the world. So it becomes less a pressure of you need to do something and you need to fix yourself, and more of a discussion about how someone is valued as a human being.
That's very well put. And, you know, I think one of the reasons people disconnect is they start to feel like they are more than a burden, than an asset to society or their loved ones. And they don't really have or feel like they have meaning and purpose in their life. So keeping connected and giving them opportunity to stay engaged is really important.
Jim, briefly, the Robin Williams situation has highlighted mental illness or depression, and yet has it highlighted it in such a way that seems like a lot of hype? And does it actually make it more difficult to make this, I don't want to say an easier conversation, but a conversation that people can have and feel more comfortable with? Because in some ways it feels like when someone famous does it, it almost blows things out of proportion to some extent. It's almost like, well, everyone is like Robin Williams now, or no one is like Robin Williams.
Well, and I think that was one of Essie's points as well. You're kind of conflicted. You know, you don't want to be a talking head that here's an opportunity to get in the media and, you know, spread your message. This is something that, you know, we do every day. But you also, you know, it raises awareness to a lot of people. People get scared. People react. And we want people to know that it's not a scary, terrible thing, that people live very full and satisfying lives. And, you know, treatment works and early intervention works. And it's just a matter of keeping connected.
Essie, what about awareness? To some of us, it seems almost impossible that we wouldn't have known a loved one, a close friend, a relative who's had some sort of mental health challenges. So, I mean, is awareness really at the core of what we need to find out first and then go from there?
One of the things that people need to be aware of is that when someone is mentally ill or when someone does make the decision to take their own life, that's not on you as a person in their life. It's not your responsibility. You didn't do something wrong. You didn't fail that person in some way. A lot of people with mental illness hide their symptoms because they feel like they need to, or they're afraid, or they're concerned about the very real implications of stigma. For example, you have people who would lose their jobs if they came out as mentally ill or sought treatment. And so it's important to kind of have an ongoing sensitivity to things like mood changes, people behaving a little differently. You know, if you have a friend who's normally very outgoing and tends to accept social invitations and host events, who suddenly starts to shut down, that's the time where you kind of check in with them and go, hey, what's going on? Is there something I can do to help out? You know, other people have dealt with troubles like this. Do you want help connecting you with those people?
I just agree. That was well put. It's hard to even add to that.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with Jim Dunn, Executive Director of Arizona's chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and Essie Smith, Social Justice Editor at exojane.com. Essie is with us from Fort Bragg, California. Essie, let me come to you on this. I wonder, without jumping in too much and making this too big, I'm curious as to whether you think society as a whole is too judgmental. Maybe I'll phrase it this way: unintentionally demanding, even when you talk about, well, make sure you get on your meds, I think you need assistance right now. Is there that feeling that even when people are trying to help, it might sound like they're not?
Yes, definitely. There's kind of a pressure that a lot of mentally ill people experience that the people around them expect them to fix themselves and just want them to get better. And I think even well-meaning people don't realize that the message that people who are struggling can internalize is, you're really a burden and you're causing all these problems, and why can't you just get better? What's your problem?
Jim, have you found that experience as well?
Well, and, you know, I'm sorry, just to kind of back up on, you know, one of the things I think that Essie made important in that article is we need to knock down the stigma. And it, you know, a lot of times people in professional positions don't want to reveal that they've had a challenge. So I just wanted to make sure folks know that I myself have had a lived experience as well. And we fight hard to try to knock that stigma down every day.
Well, and follow up on what Essie just said as well about this idea of whether people are judgmental even if they don't mean to be. Have you found that as well?
You know, I don't know that it's any more so than any other relationship. You know, sometimes when people aren't familiar with something, it might be scary. They might be reacting on what they know. But if you take the time to, you know, just try to get to know each other, you can break those walls down.
Jim, how difficult is it, and Essie, please jump in on this as well, how difficult is it to explain to a non-depressed person what depression feels like?
You know, I don't even know that you can do that. You know, it's just hard for people to really feel or understand, you know, what somebody else is going through. I mean, every experience is unique, and somebody might experience one event as traumatic, and somebody else might not think it's a big deal. And SC, please chime in.
I definitely agree with Jim. And, you know, I would also say it's kind of like trying to explain color to someone who is colorblind. You can try to articulate what it's like, but they have this sort of limited, muted lens through which they're viewing something. So when you talk about depression, a lot of people will say, oh, well, you know, I've been sad before. And you say, I totally acknowledge that, and I know that was a difficult experience for you, but this is different. And well, depression takes a lot of forms, but it's this pit, this black hole that you really don't know until you've been inside it.
And a lot of time it's more of a can you look at functional limitations, and it becomes hard to get out of bed. It's hard to answer the phone. You don't want to answer the door. Fear and foreboding, and you just kind of feel worse and worse every day.
Jim, with the work you've done, and I know it varies, as we said, from person to person. A person can deal with an episode in a different way. It can affect them completely differently. What are some advances you've seen that are encouraging to you? Are there certain medicines that are working well? Are there certain therapies that are working well?
You know, they've actually made great strides in medications, but, you know, there's always side effects in almost in every treatment intervention. You know, one of the biggest advances have been in peer support, and Arizona, believe it or not, has been on cutting edge since 98, early 2000s, on bringing individuals with lived experience, kind of training them how to use that experience to help other individuals kind of navigate a system of care. And we've worked with people straight out of an urgent crisis care center one week and go through a six-week peer support training program and go out and run wellness groups for 30 other people a month later. It's amazing.
But what advances does Arizona need to make? What advances does Congress need to make, or someone, in order to make mental health care more accessible and make it better?
They just need to do a relationship, you know, walk the talk. You know, we know it's a relationship model. We've got great legislation in Congress on both sides of the parties. You know, some things nobody agrees on, some things make sense. Let's move forward on the things that make sense. But, you know, if we're going to believe that individuals can recover, we got to believe that systems and providers and even communities and governments can recover as well.
What about mental health first aid, this idea, even first responders and law enforcement?
Obviously a great idea, and Representative Victoria Steele introduced that over the past 2 years, and I think got funding both years, but really wanted to try to help out the Department of Education. That's something that NAMI's looking at as well, because I don't know that the teachers are adequately prepared in how to recognize an early intervention, and they can start breaking down the stigma at elementary school.
Well, in an ideal situation, how much training would need to be done for that, Jim?
You know, probably just one course, one block, you know. It doesn't take a whole lot, but it's an investment at least as worth any other three-credit course.
SE, finally, are there any other advances that you've heard about, that you've experienced, that you think people need to know more about going forward that might erase the stigma or limit it a little bit more, so people realize that, you know, people they know might have this problem, or you yourself might at some point too?
One thing I wanted to jump in with in terms of kind of innovative social programs is a program up in Seattle that was organized by law enforcement and the mental health community that was kind of designed as a diversion system to get mentally ill people both off the streets and out of the courts, so that when someone is in mental health crisis, the default isn't calling police and sending them to jail, but instead getting them to a crisis center where they're hooked up with social services, including connections to help them apply for health care and counseling and anything else that they might benefit from. And this system is kind of a great example of how institutional structures can support a non-stigmatized system, where the approach is much like if someone breaks their leg in the street, you know, nobody panics and calls the police and calls them a threat to public welfare and health. People call an ambulance because that's what the person needs. And so it's really exciting to see pilot programs like this spreading across the United States to get those first responders changing the way that they think about mental illness. And you also, of course, have stigma-fighting programs in the U.S. and the U.K. that involve people with mental illness openly speaking about mental health conditions and what it's like to live with this experience.
S.E. Smith is social justice editor at exojane.com. Jim Dunn is executive director of Arizona's chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Thanks to you both. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll introduce the first in a new series called We Are the Valley, looking at community in this area. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Arts Center, announcing its performing live season. Penn and Teller, The Mythbusters, Bill Cosby, and more. Pre-show dinner packages and single tickets on sale now. Schedule at mesaartscenter.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM. Checking temperatures around the state right now, cloudy and 59 degrees in Flagstaff. It's cloudy and 68 in Prescott. Sunny skies and 86 degrees in Tucson. And under partly cloudy skies, it's 94 in Yuma. Checking valley traffic on the I-10 westbound, the shoulder at Ray Road is now clear again after an earlier accident there. On the I-17 southbound, the crash on the frontage road at Thunderbird has been moved off to the side. And on the southbound I-17, the lanes at Union Hills are now clear again. Partly sunny skies, we have 62% relative humidity, and it's 83 degrees at 1121.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Valley is a unique place, growing and welcoming new people from across the country and around the world. How does a place like this define what community is? And how do our smaller communities of faith or arts or other passions fit into the larger picture of this area? Over the next few months, we'll be exploring those themes in a series called We Are the Valley. We kick it off this morning with a conversation with Patricia Gober, Arizona State University research professor and author of Metropolitan Phoenix, Placemaking and Community Building in the Desert.
There's a difference between what Chicago means to Chicagoans and what Phoenix means to Phoenicians. I'm not sure that Chicago has changed that much over time, and Phoenix has changed that much over time, but this is a special place, and it's different from a Chicago or a Baltimore or a Philadelphia. And what I think is that some of the older, more stable cities have large populations that were born and raised and lived there, and they have what we call a sense of place, a sense of history. Public monuments are important to how they define themselves and the place and what it means to be a Chicagoan. I think in a place like Phoenix, it's different. Two-thirds of the population was born someplace else. Most of us are newcomers or have moved to Phoenix in some time in the past. And what we share is kind of a sense of Phoenix now, and we share a sense of Phoenix in the future. So our connection to an ever-changing place with a lot of throughput is quite different than a sense of place in a more stable eastern or midwestern city.
From your perspective, how much does walkability, population density have to do with building a community? Because this is such a sprawling place. We talk about how different it is in that sense to almost the car culture. When you think about a community, how important is it for things to be close together, for people to be able to walk to see friends, family, do activities?
I think it is an important part of community. If you think of community as a network of people, people who come together on a regular basis, the densities that allow them to do that, the fact that you're going to see your neighbors and interact with other people when you're on foot or on a bicycle are key features. But, you know, with the nature of today's technology, we interact with people in many different ways. And so there are all kinds of social networks. And the social networks that people build in a walkable urban environment are but one of a number of the social networks that are meaningful and important for their lives, I think.
How do you think the way that one of the reasons that Phoenix grew initially, post-World War II, people who had been stationed here and sort of fell in love with the clear skies and the weather, and those who had to come because of health concerns, which ironically is sort of the reverse now. How do you think that affected how, as far as the type of people who came here initially post-World War II, how did that affect how the community was built at that time?
I'd add a few, the health migrants and the GIs, the retirees who moved initially to Sun City West, and the immigrants that are coming to Phoenix today. They came to Phoenix to renew themselves, build a new life, create something different, look to the future. So I think that kind of cultural characteristic is in our bones. It's not to look back to the historical monuments, but to look forward to where we'll be 20 years from now. And I think that's built into the DNA of all those migrants who came here in the past. I think that there's also been a large, I used the word before, the throughput of the population. 50,000 people move in, but 30,000 people move out in a given year. So you've got a lot of movement taking place. And you might not have the deepest of local connections that you would have in a city that's a more stable city.
Professor Gober, one thing that came to mind, my wife and I were talking about this the other day. We had been in San Francisco last summer and talked about how, and I think of these as positives. I'm not sure if the people who live there do or not, but there's, of course, a Chinatown. There's an area for a lot of Italian residents and Italian restaurants, for example. Phoenix doesn't seem to have that, I don't think, unless I'm wrong, and correct me if I am. Is that an important part of building a community as well, places where we have pockets of different sort of aspects of culture, or are we redefining that as a city and as a generation?
Well, I might take issue with you on that. The first Friday downtown, I mean, we've got places where all kinds of people come together and interact with each other. They may not live together as they would have in a traditional Chinatown, but I think it's that hunger people have for being in public spaces. It just takes a different form in Phoenix. Piestewa Peak on a Saturday morning, Tempe Town Lake on a Sunday afternoon, people are fishing and walking and being. And I think we have those places. It would be nice if we had more, but I think they just have a Phoenix character to them that aren't what we would see in San Francisco.
How much of the name of the city, not the valley, but the city of Phoenix, plays into maybe dreams people might have when they come here or that feeling of being reborn?
You know, I can tell you I talk about Phoenix a lot, and I talk about Phoenix to people who live in Phoenix as well as I travel. People say, what is it like to live in Phoenix? And I say, well, they don't call it Phoenix for nothing. And conjuring up the prehistoric Hohokam rising, or the modern Phoenix rising from the ashes of this previous civilization, you know, resonates more with outsiders than it does insiders. I see people kind of roll their eyes when I make that connection. But when I make that connection to outsiders, they really nod their heads and understand that this is a place where people go to be reborn and to be renewed, and the place is always changing in reflection of that.
We've heard from people who feel like Phoenix, the Valley, the reputation is a place that is community-less, even as you talked about a place that's been built by people from so many other places. What would you say to someone if they said, oh, Phoenix, it's a community-less place? I come on.
It's a different kind of community than what we think of as the stereotypical large city. That I think community takes a different form in Phoenix than it does in other places. I can tell you from my own experience, I live part-time now in a city that's filled with insiders, and I'm an outsider. And it's hard to be an outsider in an insider kind of city. We assimilate newcomers spectacularly well because our traditional communities might not be as tight and well organized as what you'd find in Baltimore or San Francisco. I think nonetheless, we're getting the job done, even though community has a different feel to it than it might in other places.
Patricia Gober is a research professor at ASU and author of Metropolitan Phoenix, Placemaking and Community Building in the Desert. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. We continue the discussion as part of our community series, We Are the Valley, with Cindy Dash, among other things, co-owner of Changing Hands Bookstore and a founding member of Local First Arizona. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
So how would you define community, and how do you think, based on other places you've lived, how Phoenix compares?
Community to me has been a place where you recognize people, you have some of a history with those people, common interests with those people, and there's just a familiarity to that. Definitely, Phoenix is challenging compared to other cities because other cities, I grew up in New York, there's a density that we just don't have. And with density, you do recognize people, you do pass pass you them in the street. You know the store owners. And we are missing that density here, so that you have to travel more to find your community in Phoenix.
And that's been one of the things talking about sprawl when it comes to the suburbs, when it comes to comparing that to a downtown area. Downtown Phoenix gets a lot of attention, and many people would say a big city downtown should get attention. Is there a feeling, though, because we spend so much attention on downtown, that outside communities aren't able to thrive quite as much?
It's definitely more challenging. I think we are seeing a trend as chains are closing, such as, for example, the large bookstore chains are shutting their doors. We are seeing more local coffee shops pop up. You know, that downfall of the economy made people stay in places that they didn't necessarily plan on staying. So they're starting to, those people are starting to finally invest in their sprawl places. Mm-hmm. And I think we are seeing places pop up, such as coffee houses or gathering spaces where people can start forming a community. But it's an action. It's an active act that somebody has to make to find community in Phoenix.
Well, I mean, does that in some ways make the community stronger, having to work a little bit harder to build it? Or does it mean that there's something else going on there?
You know, I think we are finally coming out of that I hate Phoenix, and that it was a community unto itself for a very long time here. And now we're getting defensive, and now we're fighting for our communities, and we're fighting to make them better. And I mean fighting in the way that, you know, we're arm in arm doing this. So I think it makes it stronger because we've worked harder. In it's not easy to find like-minded people. It's not easy to find your group. You might often have to drive far. So that once we find it, we're very defensive.
The I Hate Phoenix effort, which of course we still hear once in a while, is there a feeling that that makes it even more difficult in this sense, that a lot of people may sort of throw up their hands and say, okay, I've tried for a few years. This place isn't going to change, so I'm getting out of here. Does that make it that much harder to make that community a real strong foundation?
You know, it makes it harder and easier. We're a city that those people will leave. They're going to go to other places. Again, that when the economy turned, you know, went into that downturn, it was harder for people to leave, but at least the haters leave. So that the people who are willing to stay and make it better and get involved don't necessarily have to deal with that friction. Where in your larger cities, you know, New York is a place where I've always said people hate that they love to live there, or they love that they hate living there. And we don't have that as much.
Do you see any time where Phoenix does get like that? I mean, if our growth has slowed a little bit, but if it picks up again as the economy picks up, is this a place that you think can adjust on the fly if it needs to, and also keep that unique flavor that we have?
You know, that's a great question, because we are still evolving. So much of the flavor that we become, it might not even be here yet. Some of the makers, some of the people who will get involved haven't arrived yet. Or, I mean, what is interesting is watching how many kids are graduating high school and college and choosing to stay because they can get involved here. And they're a whole new generation, you know, very tech savvy, and they have different values around work and volunteering. So I think what's important is that for the older leadership to actually be able to step back and watch the younger leadership and learn from them, because they really are going to make the Phoenix of the next 20 years more than the people that have been doing it for the past 40 years.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Cindy Dash, who, among other things, is co-owner of Changing Hands Bookstore. Now, the Changing Hands that just opened recently on Camelback, where the Beefeaters used to be, is on the light rail line. And what difference does transportation make in building a community? The fact that public transit in the Valley hasn't been that exciting, light rail seem to get people pumped up. When you're stereotyped as more of a car community, does that make it more of a challenge? We talked a little bit about sprawl, but specifically about a transportation line and having things, community gathering places along a transportation line.
You know, it's essential. Again, I do come from a city where mass transit was there long before I was even born. And it's that place where you do recognize people because you get on that schedule. So you're going to recognize somebody across the light rail seat from you that is on the same schedule as you. And it just feels like a community because it's a little bit safer. You recognize people. And having those gathering places, which are finally seeing coming back on the light rail line, is essential. And, you know, we can't forget light rail came around in 2009. So we do have a generation of students who grew up going to high school and have now graduated high school who are very savvy to mass transit.
Where do you think the little communities, when I say little, but little in terms of the number of people perhaps in some cases, where we have certain interests that people are involved in, and that's how someone comes together with a certain passion, how do you think that ultimately builds into the greater community? Are these all pieces of a puzzle? Is it okay if they don't all fit neatly together?
You know, Yes, absolutely. I think, like everywhere, when people are trying to find their community, whether it be they look for a book club or they look for a writing group or they look for other people who play golf or other people who play tennis, that's an active effort. But here in Phoenix, what I see is the overlapping of those communities. So you might go to something like the McDowell Mountain Music Festival, which I personally think is one of the best community gathering events that has happened in downtown Phoenix, and you're seeing those groups collide, and they're colliding around art. And in other cities where your density is so big, where you might have 9 concerts going on the same day, you don't see those groups collide. They tend to be more siloed. So I see a lot of overlapping here of those communities.
Where does conflict fit into community, as long as the conflict is not, I'm going to stab you in the face? I mean, can people really have a healthy disagreement as they build the community?
I hope so.
Okay.
I really hope so. At times, there's definitely people, it seems, fighting for mediocrity or fighting for change for the sake of change, or fighting for things to stay the same for the sake of change. And I think we just have to be able to see each other's perspective. And that's, you know, that's true in a relationship and that's true in a community. And we have to bring that knowledge to every battle that we have.
So ultimately, if there are disagreements and we move forward with the great passion people have about these ideas, What keeps that passion healthy? What keeps it feeling like we're moving in the right direction and progress is being made? Progress is brought up a lot. People define that in different ways as well.
You know, I think people have to know what makes them happy. And again, I'll bring up the McNown Music Festival. I am part of a community of people who have fought to have a more walkable, bikeable, arts-friendly city. And to go to a festival like that and see all my people who having a good time and enjoying it, that's where you say, yep, it's been worth it. Those battle wounds have been okay to suffer because look what we've achieved. And, you know, the revamping of Hans Park is something that makes people feel good. So we have to have successes along the way. And I think our current leadership understands that. And we really have to honor our successes and not just beat up the bumps along the way, which there are going to be many, many more.
Well, again, when it comes from building a small community into a bigger community, whether there's conflict or not, how important is it to be comfortable with how your ideas fit into a smaller group, but also being open to the other ideas? It seems that when a place is growing like this one is, with people from all over the place and people with different ideas, it's got to be vitally important to at least be open to the discussion, doesn't it?
You have to be open, but what we have to be wary about is having a mediocre outcome because we've tried to make so many people happy. So at some point, you have to get input from the community, have the community fight for what they want, but have experts, and not just out-of-town experts that don't know our landscape or our climate, but experts to really say, here's what you want transformed to what your climate and population can achieve. And to really understand that what works in Portland, you know, Powell's Bookstore is a great example of that. It's a fantastic bookstore. It rains there most of the time. You know, I can never have as many people in my store because our weather's so beautiful. So it really is, we have to be very cautious not to have mediocrity because we're trying to make everybody happy.
And Cindy, you segued very well in the last question I wanted to have for you, which is, Phoenix is so unique in so many ways, but are there other cities we can learn from and places that you've seen you think, boy, if Phoenix took that idea, this would really be great?
You know, absolutely. I think we're really shy of having really great public gathering spaces, small and large. Parks is a place where I made most of my friends in my 20s in Central Park. And we don't have enough of those places that are free, that don't have an entry fee. I really believe, I mean, First Fridays is this great gathering event, in part because there's no admission charge. And more parks, more pocket parks, more dog parks, where people can just come together because they need to take a walk, is what we can learn from other cities.
Cindy Dash is, among other things, co-owner of Changing Hands Bookstore, also one of the original founders of Local First Arizona. Cindy, thanks for kicking off We Are the Valley with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We're only 13 days away from primary election day in Arizona, and if you want to request an early ballot, you've only got 2 days left to do that. At this point, nearly 76,000 independents requested early ballots in Maricopa County. More than 45,000 of those wanted a Republican ballot. That probably speaks to how many competitive Republican races there are when compared with Democratic races. But the chair of the state GOP says it actually means Democrats have implemented a strategy in the races for governor, attorney general, and secretary of state, denying Democrats and independents the opportunity to choose a nominee. Democratic strategist Bob Grossfeld, president and CEO of the Media Guys, joins me to talk a little bit about that. Hi, Bob.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. So what do you think? Is Robert Graham correct? Are the Democrats disenfranchising voters?
No, but he should not go into the business of stand-up comedy, I don't think.
Well, he had you chuckling, though.
Yes, because on the face of it, that's just a silly thing for him to be saying. When you look at the breakdown of, and you mentioned it, you know, roughly 45,000 getting GOP ballots, 30,000 getting the Democratic ballots, that shouldn't be surprising given the fact that all of the primary activity is taking place on the Republican side. I mean, if you were to take his thought to a logical extension, it should be zero Democrats and all of them going into the Republican primary trying to influence that insanity.
Does this mean to you, though, the Democrats are putting up very strong candidates? Does it also mean there aren't enough qualified potential candidates to have a primary battle? And where do you stand on the importance of having a primary fight?
Well, I guess it let me take that in two parts. I think there are plenty of Democratic candidates. We've just seem to have come up with several of them who are just at the top of the pile in Duvall and Rodolini and Goddard and David Garcia, who is surprising everybody with his strength. And so... There's little need for a primary, except in a couple scattered legislative races, which is frankly the same as it is with the Republican legislative races. They're going to be determined in the primary.
Mm-hmm. Bob, in that bigger picture sense, though, do you feel like it matters? You know, people have these different opinions about saying, well, you get ready for the general by having to fight it out and have your ideas revealed during the primary. Are you saying in this case, since you think you've got strong candidates, you don't need that?
Well, I think politics isn't exactly like a Broadway show where you start in Buffalo and, you know, work out the kinks before you get to New York. You're working things out as you go along. And in this case, what happens is, and we've had a couple of these elections over the last, you know, 10 to 20 years, where you have the Republicans with multiple candidates, and I think the best example is the gubernatorial race that they're running, where they're just tearing each other to shreds. And that, to some extent, they're providing all of the negative campaigning that any Democratic campaign would want in terms of running against one of them. So it's like, is there some advantage of being battle tested? I think is the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think some minor help of doing a shakedown of your campaign. But if you look at the arguably the top three running for governor, attorney general, and secretary of state, we've got three candidates who are well battle tested,
mm-hmm.
and have put together campaigns that are probably ready to go right away and should be.
So, Bob, when you're watching the GOP primary races, especially the governor's race, I'll say attorney general as well with Tom Horn and Mark Brnovich, how closely does the strategy need to be set up during the primary, or is that a danger because you're not quite sure who's going to come out as the winner?
Well, I think to some extent the strategy is the strategy. And the who the winner is more of an adjustment, I think, because from the point of view of the Democrats, the Republicans are pretty much saying all the same stuff. They're just saying it in different ways and aiming barbs at each other. But, you know, if you were to boil it all down and throughout the Republican Party, it's they're running against Obama. They're running against Obamacare. They're running against Obama's border, Obama's unemployment. One person said they're running against Obama's herpes. I mean, anything they can think of to try and tie the president to some issue that really has absolutely nothing to do with the federal government, because he tests so poorly, particularly among Republicans, but generally as well. He's just, his numbers are not very good.
Democratic strategist Bob Grossfeld, president and CEO of the Media Guys. Bob, thanks.
A pleasure.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll take a trip along Route 66 with longtime Valley artist and writer Bob Bozbell. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the ASU Surplus Store, helping teachers get back to school with classroom supplies from file folders to file cabinets and more. Open Monday to Friday, 12 to 4. Rio Salado and the Loop 101 in Tempe. Surplus.asu.edu.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Checking Valley traffic on the Loop 101 Pima Freeway, there is a vehicle on fire that's eastbound at 56th Street. Storms will continue to move through the valley today. We could get a quarter to a half an inch of rain today, and our high will be 96 degrees. Stay with us at 12 o'clock for NPR's Here and Now. We'll hear about the U.S.'s continuing military and humanitarian mission in Iraq. Right now, it's partly sunny in the valley and 83 degrees at 11:46.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The tales of Route 66 have been told for decades. When it was first established in 1926, the roadway covered more than 2,400 miles from Illinois to California, and it brought millions of dreamers and vacationers to what many hoped would be a magical land. In his new graphic novel-like memoir, The 66 Kid, True West magazine publisher and longtime Valley artist and writer Bob Bozbell spins his own story of growing up in Kingman along Route 66. He started by telling me why, after all these years, he decided to write about his childhood.
Well, the weird thing is that I had a heart attack 5 years ago, and I almost died at a band reunion in Kingman playing the drums on the song Wipeout. And I know that sounds just absolutely ridiculous, and it was. And I always had the idea that I'd like to write about growing up on Route 66. And after I survived the heart attack, I thought, well, if I ever do that, I guess I better get busy. And so last year, in 2013, I heard that they were having the International Route 66 Festival in my hometown of Kingman, Arizona, and that lit a fire under me.
Give us some background about how you got to Kingman, how your family got there. Describe what Kingman was like in those days.
Well, when we moved to Kingman in 1947, my father was drafted into the Army during World War II, and he arrived there on a troop train on his 21st birthday, and he was walking down the center of the street, which was Route 66, and he muttered to himself, "I'll never come back to this hellhole." There was 500 available women there, give or take, and there were 10,000 GIs, and my mother was from a ranching family in that area, and she was dating captains and lieutenants, and she was engaged to one of the big ranchers, but she fell for a buck private from Thompson, Iowa. And so they were married. We began this long ping pong game between Thompson, Iowa and Kingman, Arizona. And every summer we drove Route 66 to visit the farm. And for a brief period, we lived in Iowa and went the other way. So when I was growing up there, it was very isolated. And we didn't have a radio reception. We'd have to listen to KOMA at night because it came out of Oklahoma City. And we had no television. This is in the mid-50s. It was a dirt road to Phoenix. I know this sounds like Civil War stuff. But it was really isolated, and the one thing that connected us to the rest of the world was this long two-lane black top ribbon called Route 66. And that's what I grew up on, and I iced jugs for free in my dad's gas station, Al Bell's Flying A, right on Route 66. And when I was growing up, I didn't think much of it. You know, it's hard to spot legends from the side of the road. And both my parents worked for the made their living from it. My mother works at the highway department. I always thought I was kind of irritated by, well, what's the deal? It's just a road. And in 2013, I was in Spain, believe it or not, looking for Cowboy Ground Zero. For True West magazine, I'd kind of assigned myself the assignment, where is Cowboy Ground Zero? If you trace it all the way back into Spain, I'll bet you there's a conquistador place where one of the conquistadors came from that is where the cowboy started. And so I found myself on the beach in Rota, Spain, which is where Columbus set forth on his second journey to the Americas. Well, I stood there looking at this for about 20 minutes, and I got ready to leave, and I turned around, and on the beach I saw the Route 66 bar. And I thought to myself, I've come 5,000 miles looking for the source of one legend, only to discover the fruits of another.
What is the appeal, then, of Route 66? Because it is, when people think about Arizona, even today, I think they think a lot of, even though Route 66 was obviously much bigger than that, they think about the Grand Canyon, they think about Route 66. What is the pull about that? What does it say about America, do you think?
I had to ask someone else to tell me, and I was talking to a photographer, he lives here now, his name is Brian Black, and he's from Ireland. And he told me that he loved Route 66, and I said, you have to tell me, what's the big deal? And this is what he told me. He said, it's the road that leads to the American dream and the prettiest women in the world. And when you think about it, it's the road to Disneyland and it's the road to Hollywood. And he said when he moved here, he would see signs that said Los Angeles, 350 miles, he still feels like he's in a movie.
What has the West lost, if anything, or what has the U.S. lost since Route 66 is just a nostalgic piece now as opposed to an actually active piece?
I really believe that for everything we gain, we lose something, and everything we lose, we gain something. When I was a kid in the 1950s, I was chasing the ghosts of the Old West, which was only 50 years before. And so we would go out to these ghost towns, and they were still standing, and there were still old people that I would talk to my grandparents and stuff, and they remembered Black Jack Ketchum, and they remembered some of the outlaws. And so what's weird is that the world that I grew up in, which was vibrant and had neon and all these super gas stations and stuff, now it is the Old West. And every time I go down Route 66 on the old alignment, there's another thing that's gone and disappeared. And so it's really bizarre that I've lived long enough to see the world that I grew up in, which was very modern at the time, become old and antiquated and gone. And so there's a certain tragedy to that because it happens to all of us. But ultimately, you just have to embrace it and remember what Nietzsche said, which is you can't win, you can't break even, and you can't leave the game.
Longtime Valley writer and artist Bob Bozbell. He's also the publisher of the Cave Creek-based True West magazine. His new graphic novel-like memoir is called The 66 Kid. And here's a song called The 66 Kid, written and performed by Valley blues legend Hans Olsen after some arm twisting by Bob Bozbell. It's Here and Now on KGAZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Arizona State's football team is at its home away from home, Camp Tontazona near Payson, as players practice and bond in anticipation of the 2014 season kicking off later this month. Tyler Lockman is the ASU beat writer for FoxSportsArizona.com. He says this is a big year for head coach Todd Graham as he continues to implement his system.
With a lot of new head coaches, the third year is kind of that year where they're expected to make it big, but they sort of did that in year two, going to a Pac-12 championship game. So this year, it's sort of an interesting situation for Todd Graham and his team. They did lose a lot of players, 14 total starters. But right now, I think when you look at strengths of this team, it's absolutely the offense. They have so many playmakers, so many stars, and so much experience from the offensive line, the receivers, all over, that offense should be able to score a ton of points. And I think you're going to see them win a lot of shootouts. And they're going to have to win a lot of shootouts, probably early in the year, especially while that defense finds its legs. But they do have some nice pieces on defense. And I think they'll be improved in special teams because they had Keith Patterson come in from West Virginia, and he's really kind of overhauled their philosophy on special teams.
Defensively, they lost a couple of big names, at least. Will Sutton, people probably know about, got drafted to the NFL. Carl Bradford also got drafted to the NFL. It sounded like they had a couple of people in mind, maybe junior college players, to come in and replace either one or both of those guys, but they're not going to be eligible. Is there some last-minute planning that's going to be tough at this point?
Well, they did. They lost two junior college recruits from the same junior college in Mississippi. They thought those were guys that were going to come in and be able to start and sort of replace those big-time playmakers. That didn't work out. There's always a risk with junior college players that they might not meet the academic requirements to get into the school. So that sort of caused them to do some shifting. And one of those spots is the devil linebacker position, where right now they're still kind of figuring out what they're going to do there. They had a tight end playing there, and maybe they're not going to do that as much anymore. But then that spot where Will Sutton played is another one right now. They have a true freshman working there with the first-team defense right now. So those are two spots, especially, that were affected by those guys not making it. And that's caused them to do some figuring things out, trying different guys and figuring out what's going on. And I think they're getting closer to determining who's going to be their best option there, but they're not quite there yet.
Traditionally, regardless of what coaches say publicly, they usually get a little nervous playing guys who are too inexperienced. Has there been any indication that Todd Graham's nervous about this?
No, he doesn't give any indication of that. He might be, but he wouldn't let you know it. I think the thing with Todd Graham is he is so confident in his system, in his scheme, that he believes you could put anyone in it. As long as they know the defense, they know their calls, they know where they're supposed to be, you can just put anyone there and they'll succeed because of the system. So he's played young guys before, and they're going to have to this year. He knows that. So that for him, there's really no reason to be nervous. It doesn't do him any good, or at least not to show that.
Have you had a chance to look at their schedule? How does it look to you? Does it look like they're a lot of tough non-conference opponents, or fairly easy? Can they get off to a good start this year?
Well, it's kind of an interesting schedule this year. They have three games early on, one against an FCS school, so a lower division, Weber State, and then they play Colorado and also New Mexico. So those are three games that they should be expected to win. They should get off to a 3-0 start, but after that, they have UCLA here in Tempe, and then they have to go to Los Angeles to play USC. So right away, those are two very important division games that really could determine their season within the first 5 weeks. If those two are going to be competitors for the South, and those are two games they've, really got to worry about. And then later in the year, you have Notre Dame as a non-conference game. That's here in Tempe. Obviously, that's not as much of an impact in the Pac-12, but it's a big game for the program.
How tough is that Notre Dame game potentially in that, I don't know how ticket sales work, but Notre Dame has people everywhere, and they like to buy as many tickets as they can. Is ASU able to limit that, or are there enough season tickets where ASU's crowd will dominate the crowd?
My understanding is the only way to get a ticket to that game, or guarantee a ticket to that game right now, is to buy season tickets.
Okay.
So from what I hear, a lot of Notre Dame fans, be they here or from Indiana, purchase season tickets just so they can guarantee themselves that one ticket to that one game. They make the trip out here, and then the rest of their season tickets they can sell or not use or anything. So I think you'll see a fairly big Notre Dame contingent, but I do think you'll probably see more ASU fans, obviously, with the size of that stadium.
Camp Tonozona, big week there coming for the team. Why does Todd Graham believe in that tradition?
Well, Todd Graham's a really big fan of Frank Cush, the legendary coach, who sort of helped build Camp Tonozona. So they moved away from that tradition under Dennis Erickson because their practice facility here in Tempe with the indoor bubble was completed, and they said, well, what's our purpose of going up there anymore? It rains, the field can be bad, so, we'll just stay here. As the Erickson era waned, people kind of missed that tradition, and then when Todd Graham arrived, they said, you know what, let's go back, because that's such a great tradition, and it really helped invigorate the fans. They get to go up there. It's kind of hearkening back to a more successful era. And it's a place where they get to go and sort of have this bonding time as a team.
Tyler Lachman, ASU beat writer for FoxSportsArizona.com. Tyler, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help. If you have any ideas or suggestions for our We Are the Valley series, send an email to us, wearethevalley@kjzz.org. Again, that's one word, wearethevalley@kjzz.org. And if you want to hear the kickoff of the series or any of our previous editions of Here and Now, they'll be online later today at kjzz.org. You can even download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. Now it's time for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, where teams of experts work together to focus on you. Learn which health plans include Mayo Clinic, or you can request an appointment at mayoclinic.org/Arizona.